Film, poetry, comedy, music and drama feature in Ireland's first Climate Arts Festival. Future Limerick opened last night in the city. Highlights from the week-long festival include comedian Colm O'Regan, writer and performer Manco McGann, as well as theatre from Broken Talkers and Sunday's Child. Future Limerick is the brainchild of Eva O'Connor and Hildegard Ryan of Sunday's Child Theatre Company. Delighted to say that both of them join me now from our Limerick studios. You're both curating this festival. Maybe I'll come to you first on this, Hildegard, but it was, I think it was your play Afloat, which opened at the Dublin Fringe Festival in 2019, that kind of was a real starting point for Future Limerick. Maybe you could remind us a little bit about what that play was about, and then we can talk about how it moved things along. What was Afloat about, first of all, Hildegard?
Hi, Sean. So Afloat is about a dystopian Dublin. Dublin has been totally destroyed by an enormous climate change catastrophe, and it's totally underwater. And two girls, Blanid and Debs, are surviving on top of Liberty Hall. So it's kind of a dark comedy about how they're surviving, how they're looking back on Dublin and saying, why didn't we do more? Why didn't we protest while we had the chance? It's a kind of entertaining, comedic take on climate change with a nice surprising twist at the end that I won't give away. We kind of made the play as a response to, I guess, our feelings of, you know, climate, I guess, anxiety and the sense that things are getting worse in the climate, but people in power aren't doing anything, and how do we as individuals deal with that?
Yeah, and in fact, Eva, you took part in the play. Did you play Blanid or Debs, one of the two women?
Yes, I played Blanid, and Blanid is, she's kind of wearing rose-tinted glasses and looking back on Dublin saying, oh, you know, it was paradise and we never appreciated what we had. And then Debs, her pal, is kind of in the background being like, do you not remember the housing crisis? You know, working people couldn't get a house. It was easier to get, something on Airbnb, which I think, you know, we wrote in 2019, but that's kind of more relevant than ever.
Yeah.
And I think when we sort of noticed that the play hit a nerve, there was a lot of Extinction Rebellion stuff happening in Dublin around that time as well. And I think it was, in a way, a bit of a tipping point in terms of the conversation. And then funding came up from ESB Brighter Futures Award, and people kept on sending us the link being like, guys, this looks like your play.
Yeah.
And me and Hildy kind of conceived of the festival.
Right.
And
well, I'll come back to what you conceived of in the conception of that festival itself. But I want to listen to a little clip from Afloat, which features yourself, Eva, as Blanid, and Annette O'Shea as Debs. A little bit of language in the midst of all of this. And yes, they are in a rather precarious situation, it has to be said, as outlined in the play Afloat.
The whole ground is shaken now.
A fucking earthquake in Dublin? Town is chaos. People are leaping into cars, driving like maniacs. Someone yells that the Liffey has burst its banks. But how can that be? And I've had panic attacks before and I can feel one coming on now. My breath is shallow and this lad beside me grabs my arm. Run, he yells, and I drop my bag and start sprinting.
I'm sprinting now on autopilot. The adrenaline is like rocket fuel. I'm afraid to look behind me because I know what I'll see. A wall of grey sea just charging towards me. I take out my phone and I'm dialing Blanid's number. Over.
It's over. My life is over. It's the end of the fucking world. People are smashing into me.
And that's a little clip from Afloat, one of the pieces that's going to feature in this new Climate Arts Festival, Future Limerick. And the curators of the festival are with me this evening. Eva O'Connor, whose voice you heard in the midst of that clip there, along with her co-curator, Hildegard Ryan. And at one level, Hildegard, you know, yeah, I can find myself, you kind of laugh at their situation in one way. But there is, you are making some very serious points here. I mean, that was first performed back in 2019. I'm guessing the statistics that you had on climate back in 2019 are probably well out of date by now, are they?
Yeah, it's funny actually. Whenever we do the show, we have to research all the facts again because they've always gotten way worse and they're changing at a really fast pace we can't even keep up with. So yeah, part of my fun job is finding out the dark facts and telling our actor, Michael David, who plays a kind of scientist character in the play, the bad news that he has to learn new lines.
A very technical material that he has to relearn. And you know, learning the new ones is much harder than that because you have to forget the old ones. That's the difficult bit about all of that. So what are your hopes, Eva, in terms of future Limerick? What do you think that the arts can possibly do that, you know, a lot of talk seems not to have done up to now?
Yeah, that's what myself and Hildegard have, I suppose, been tossing around between us for a good few years now. Like, what role does the arts play in kind of raising awareness and, I suppose, energizing people is one of our aims. Like, you know, that kind of call to action, you know, encouraging people to organize. I think, like, you know, we're all so aware of the facts now more than ever. You know, we have the IPCC report. Everyone, I think it's, you know, we read the articles every day. And I think, you know, not taking action is really not an option at this point. Like, myself and Hildegard are also involved in kind of, you know, climate organizing as well. Hildy was arrested recently with a campaign called Just Stop Oil. So we've had a lot of debates about, you know, where as artists can, you know, where, what is our actual role? Is there one for us? And there's a really amazing line actually in Rising, the other play that we might talk about in a bit, but it talks about rising up in 1916 and how we rose up then and will we rise up again? And I think that the arts can really, it won't have all the answers, but it really can spark questions. And I suppose that's what we're trying to do with the programme that we have, and also entertain people as
Absolutely,
the arts do so well.
And we got that. We got a sense of that in the flow. But you brought up the play Rising, so let's stick with it for the time being, Hildegard. This was originally a broken talker script set in and around Dublin. So have you adapted it or changed it in some ways now, for future Limerick?
Yeah, so we've adapted the play to be about Limerick now. So we've kind of been interviewing people, Limerick residents, and finding out their kind of strong emotions and associations with the River Shannon, and kind of incorporating that into the play text with Broken Talker's blessing, essentially. So what we have is now a kind of immersive audio experience on the River Shannon that talks about the local area, you know, what will happen when the water rises up, and, you know, how, I guess, climate change will affect our local communities and not just kind of abstract things in the world. It's going to be us. And even though Ireland's very mild temperatures in the summer, it's still going to come for us eventually. And that's kind of the theme of the play.
Yeah, and I suppose there is, you know, the common misconception is, oh, shouldn't it be lovely to have a great summer?
Yeah.
The great summer will be a huge problem.
Absolutely. We have a scene in the play. Basically, the play is an audio piece, but we have kind of physical movement kind of throughout it. And we have a massive water fight scene where they're talking about all the OAPs are putting on sunscreen and everyone's having water fights. And we thought it was all so great and brilliant, you know.
And won't it brilliant to go to Kilkee and, like, you know, lie on the beach and eat ice creams? And it very much is dispelling that myth, yeah. I think. And it also talks really well, really kind of articulately about how climate change affects, you know, lower class people quicker than it will anyone else, and how, you know, rich people have the power to move away, you know, you can buy a house somewhere else, you know,
yeah.
And I suppose it's, I think that's what's great about the piece. It doesn't shy away from kind of really tricky things, but it also has this really kind of this beautiful lightness of touch that I think is so important when you're chatting about climate things.
Michelle, I'm going to listen to a clip featuring Michelle Fox here. Is Michelle playing a specific character, or maybe which of you could put it in context for me? Maybe which of you is it that's going to put it in context?
She's playing herself as in...
And that's
she's
you,
a,
Hildegard, is it?
Yeah,
yes.
That's me, sorry. She's playing herself as in she's a young woman living in Limerick who's very passionate about the climate crisis, and we wanted it to be authentic and have that authentic Limerick voice, and that's what Michelle brings.
Well, let's have a listen.
We know the story, but it's not enough to know it. We have to feel it. Can you feel it? Is your heart breaking? Do you cry? Do you grieve? I do. We need change, but real change is frightening. Like an earthquake. We would lose a lot, no matter what your postcode or what your bank statement says. Little changes are important, but big changes are what's needed. The people in charge are under a spell. They're even more enchanted with this broken system than we are. We need to show them the way. Will we rise up? We've risen up before. We're known for it around here. We name streets after rebels, like the street I live on, Casement Avenue. When it was time to rise up, it was this community and communities like it. It's time to rise up again. Not for a flag, not for a nation, but for our planet home.
And that's Michelle Fox there in a clip from Rising. And that Rising was originally a Broken Talker script set in and around Dublin, but now relocated to Shannon. And it's a headphones drama, as Eva O'Connor and Hildegard Ryan of the Future Limerick Climate Arts Festival have been explaining to us just before that. Tonight then, Eva, is at the Bell Table. Yes, Scratch Night at the Bell Table. Five short plays. What's involved here?
Exactly. That's actually happening as we speak, Sean. So it's a really exciting
night.
There.
I'm sure you would love to be. Well, you'll get some of them, won't you? You will get some of them after you finish chatting to me.
Yeah, we basically programmed five new writers, kind of emerging writers from all over Ireland. And we have some brilliant actors, like local Limerick talent acting and directing. And when me and Hildy put the call out for short plays, we were really floored by people's imagination and their optimism and their zany ideas. And I think, you know, we're less emerging and a bit more emerged company now at this stage. We've been making work for about 10 years and we remembered how important that platform was to us as young artists, and it's just been brilliant to see what has kind of the talent that has flourished around this night. And then later we've got live music and poetry. We've got a bilingual night called Rec that goes on after it. So yeah, we just have a really buzzy week planned.
Yeah, I'm just looking at some of the plays, the short plays that are going to be performed or read this evening. Water seems to be a big theme when we listen to both the clips that we've heard, and I'm looking here at Whale by Rosa Malika, A Giant Whale Washes Up on a Small Coastal Town in Ireland, and Plan Animals by Mark Lawrence, kind of a take on Noah's Ark, but involving the animals themselves doing the admin, possibly.
Yeah, that's a hilarious piece, yeah, actually.
Possibly better than the humans doing the admin in this particular case. Manchon McGann, then, what's he doing, Hildegard? This is tomorrow night, his talk, isn't it?
Yeah, so we have a talk with Manchon and also Saoirse Exton, who's a 16-year-old climate activist from Limerick. She's kind of like Limerick's Greta Thunberg. But yeah, so basically they're two very different kind of activists who have the same passion for the environment. So the idea is to talk to them both over this lovely panel evening and just kind of hear from them about their thoughts on future activism and what we can do. So I guess we're hoping it'll be a bit of an inspiring night that will kind of be a call to action.
One of the other things, you know, I suppose, and it maybe refers back to Afloat in some ways, Hildegard, is this idea of, you know, the kind of guilt that you might feel around certain aspects of climate change that's happening, maybe personal responsibility, and trying to balance that out with actually not getting bogged down in the guilt and taking some kind of action.
That's absolutely right. And that's actually the key message we have in Afloat. The idea is that, I don't know if you know, but the term carbon footprint was actually invented by BP Oil as a marketing scheme to get everyone to look at themselves rather than look at these giant oil companies. Uh-huh. So in fact, when you're at home being like, oh, I shouldn't fly, oh, I shouldn't buy a coffee cup, you're playing exactly into the hands of these oil companies and these massive corporations who are just destroying their world while we kind of fret about ourselves. So that's kind of, you know, a message I think going through a lot of our stuff is that the time for looking at individuals has ended and the time to think a bit bigger at organisations has come.
And also I think there's great power in taking any form of action. I think we spend so much time online and in our own heads as well, and I think that's a great thing about the festival and about just the arts in general, is that it brings people together and it starts these conversations and you kind of feel less alone. And we're hoping that, you know, through this week that things might also get organised out of it, and we're hoping that this festival can kind of grow year on year.
And it's a real sense then of it's activism and art really all in the one go, Hildegard. That's what you're looking for here.
Yeah, absolutely. And what a lot of activists say is that if you look, you know, into the whole world, you're going to be overwhelmed by how bad things are. But when you focus on your own community and things you can actually change, that is, you know, where, you know, hope and optimism can come in. And in fact, what you'll see that is that in small community, activism will actually inspire other groups around the country and around the world and have a much bigger impact than you think that you can make by yourself. And I think activism is a way to kind of bring back some hope and just kind of kill the kind of climate anxiety I think a lot of us are feeling.
All right. Well, listen, great to speak with both of you this evening. I don't know how many of the short plays you've missed at this stage, but I'm sure you're going to...
We'll run back for two of them.
Leg it up to the bell table now and get to see and hear the rest of them. Then, of course, you'll have that bilingual event later on. Rec, I think you told me was the name of it. That's Hildegard Ryan and Eva O'Connor speaking to me about Future Limerick, Climate Arts Festival, which runs through until Saturday the 21st. Full details on futurelimerick.ie. and booking through limetreetheatre.ie. Life and Beth tells the story of a woman whose life looks great on paper, impressive to everyone she grew up with. She makes a good living as a wine distributor. She's in a long-term relationship with a seemingly successful and nice guy. She lives in Manhattan. But with the death of her mother, Beth is forced to look at her past, and her life changes as a result. Life and Beth is written, directed and executive produced by series star Amy Schumer. Jen Gannon has been watching the series for us. She's with me in studio this evening. She really is a Marmite figure, Amy Schumer, isn't she?
She's very divisive.
Which side of the fence were you coming into this one? How strong were the preconceptions?
I had many because I'm not a fan of her comedy per se. Some of her show Inside Amy Schumer I did enjoy, but a lot of it fell flat for me because
why did it annoy you? Yeah.
She does this thing where she is presenting herself as this average every woman who bites back at sexism and is very confrontational in her manner. But then she also flips to this over-exaggerated, I'd say faux naive white woman caricature where a lot of the time she was saying many jokes that could be perceived as racist. And I think there was a lot of controversy about her problematic stand-up routine around that time as well. Mm. But I also just found her, when she moved into film with Judd Apatow for her first film, Trainwreck, which kind of plays the same autobiographical furrow as Life and Beth, it was tonally jarring for me and quite awkward. And I think it was too long. Like Judd Apatow films, they're always too long, 2 hours too much. And then she had this very disastrous film, supposed to be about female self-acceptance and female insecurities and the beauty industry and the sexism of that, called I Feel Pretty. And that felt that was just horrific, I think. And I think a lot of women became very angry by it when they went to see it. It actually had the opposite effect of what it was supposed to do. And I think, you know, even this year when she was presenting the Oscars, there was a gag that she did about not recognising Kirsten Dunst and sitting in her place beside her husband, who is also nominated for award, Jesse Plemons. And that went viral because of the huge backlash against it, because it was Kirsten Dunst's first nomination. Yeah. And she had such like a massive history of, you know, great film work, and it just felt very disrespectful. Yeah. Well, it just hit the wrong
Or Kirsten Dunst's husband, for that matter, didn't react in the manner of some spouses at the Oscar ceremonies, let's
kept
be honest.
His hands in his pockets.
Yeah. All right. So, yes, you did approach this with some preconceptions and expecting to be disappointed. So give us the basic premise. You've mentioned, you know, that it ploughs a similar furrow to her film, Inside Amy Schumer. And here, or was the television series?
Trainwreck. Trainwreck, it's very like the film Trainwreck. Yeah. It's 50% autobiographical, she said. And she started to write it, she said, when the birth of her son, Gene, and she started to think back about her past. And I think due to this, like just that perspective of being a parent, it's changed. It's a different place to what Trainwreck was. And I think it has different ideas about
parenthood. But alcohol is definitely at the front and centre here.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, she is a wine cellar, obviously. So, and it is about her relationship with that kind of mediocre sense of self that you get where you're just settling into life. And she has a relationship with this very narcissistic boyfriend, Matt, who also works for the wine cellars. Yeah. And they seem to be chugging along in life in more ways than one. And then after like the shocking death, and it was a sudden death of her mother.
Well, I really wasn't expecting that.
And it happens in episode one, so it's not a spoiler.
We're not giving anything away,
So, and she just, and it is a great use of the sign by Ace of Base, because she actually hears about her mother's death just before she has to go on stage to do karaoke of Ace of Base. And that's actually one of the funnier scenes, I think, because I think the beginning, like every, you know, comedy show or every drama, even, I think the first episode is always the hardest to get through.
You've got to know the characters. Okay, let's have a listen to a clip from early in the first episode. Amy Schumer is the character of Beth. She's shopping for clothes with her mother, Jane, who's played by Laura Benanti, who, of course, the mother loves the boyfriend more also almost than she loves the daughter.
Yeah.
And the boyfriend, it would seem, loves the mother back almost more than he loves the girlfriend. But here's the mother accusing the daughter of being unhappy with her life. And needless to say, Beth is not happy about that accusation.
I love my cool life. I have a cool job. I have a great apartment. And Matt, my boyfriend, is in New York 8.
How's it going in here, ladies?
Great, so great. I'm gonna get the jumpsuit. It's the only jumpsuit I've ever truly cared about.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Beth. No, it's fine. Mom, it's totally fine. I'm just in a rush, okay?
Well, honey, you have a camel twat.
Toe, Mom, I have camel toe, okay? That's what I have. I love you, okay? And thank you for this jumpsuit. I just have to go get ready for tonight.
Well, maybe take a shower.
I'm gonna shower already, Mom. I don't need you to tell me to shower, you know? I'm just, I, I'm really happy.
Okay.
I just want you to know that. And thank you for coming with me, okay?
I love you.
Okay, I love you. Mm-hmm. Okay, I don't know why I got mad. Okay, I'm sorry. I don't know why I got upset. I'm just, okay, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you.
You're welcome, sweetheart. She has her period. I can always tell. Her face gets...
I don't have my period, Aminata. I don't have it. Okay. But it would be fine if I did, but I don't. I love you.
I love you.
Thank you. You're goodbye. Welcome.
Amy Schumer as Beth there and Laura Benatti as her mother Jane, and Aminata was the poor shopping assistant,
yes.
Or shop assistant who had to witness and somehow deal with that mother-daughter fallout. You were saying though, as we were listening, that this isn't particularly, the series develops more into a mother-daughter or a mother a daughter-father relationship,
yeah.
Difficulties than anything else.
I think like the death, it sends her back to her hometown of Long Island, and then she starts to reminisce about her teenage experiences and the breakdown of her home life, the breakdown of her parents' marriage,
yeah.
How that affected her, and she slowly starts to re-engage with that traumatic past that maybe she'd been trying to bury, and then tries to embark on this new relationship with this blunt-talking organic farmer, John, who's played by Michael Cera, who's really great. He's based...
He doesn't actually appear until, is it episode three?
Yeah.
I was kind of... Because I was watching, I have to admit, one and two, and I was thinking, I don't know if I'm going to stick with this. And then kind of halfway through two, it took a turn, or maybe halfway through three, it took a turn. I thought, oh, there's something interesting happening now.
Very interesting. And he's based on Amy Schumer's husband, Chris, who was actually diagnosed as autistic after, I think, they got married or during, you know, the early days of their marriage. So it really is kind of a tribute to him and his character and the way he kind of behaves in that way and their relationship. But I do think none of this is new territory. And this is a sticking point for me in a way, because we've seen a lot of this recently and with a variety of female created shows. It just so happens, like you've had something like Pamela Adlon did an amazing show called Better Things, then Tig Notaro had One Mississippi, and I think the twin to this show is Somebody Somewhere, which is outstanding. I can't recommend it enough to people. It stars...
Whose story are we hearing there?
So that's Bridget Everett, the actress, and she stars as Sam, and she finds this whole new community in her very small town of Kansas that she moves back to after she is helping her sister who is ill, and then her sister dies, and it's about the death of her sister. And it kind of is, it's the same themes of grief and mental health and all of that.
So
that
you're definitely saying that Somebody Somewhere, give me the correct title again,
Somebody Somewhere,
that's well worth checking out.
However,
let's stick with Life and Beth, in because there's something that happens in Life and Beth that for me, and I think for you, was one of the most interesting aspects of it. There are flashbacks to her childhood, where we see the young Beth and we see her young teenage friends, and you get the impression of a very different teenager and developing young woman than the woman that we meet later on.
Exactly. Now, this I loved. There's these, as you said, like interpolations of her teen memories, and they're really well blended into the narrative, I think. And we see that side of the souring of the relationship that we had with her mother who was having affairs, and then we see the breakdown of one of her best friendships with her friend Liz, and the total disintegration of her parents' marriage. And Michael Rapaport, he plays her really charismatic but very troubled father who was in and out of her life for like her whole teen years. And I think that exploration of the teen days, that heartbreaking bullying, and there's this boating incident that's used as a running reference throughout the show, and you see the trauma of that, and that adds a real depth to it. And I think Violet Young, who plays the teen version of Beth, is absolutely astonishing. She's great. And it's that thing of like, she's painting a smile on her face to kind of boy along her younger sister while their world is turning completely chaotic.
And the adult sisters have
a really tense relationship. Yeah.
That's a
and
nice
I think
word for it.
That was unexpected for me, and it became, you know, the heartbeat of the show for me. And I kind of look forward to seeing those moments.
And it's very clever, because you know the way sometimes with those flashback sequences, you can kind of get lost. Say, where are we? What's happening? They managed to kind of give you enough of a little flavour of something that happened in the past that, you know, oh, that's going somewhere important. Something really important happened there. And then they switch back to the present day.
It's a good kind of punctuation for where she's at mentally, or what informed many of her decisions later on in her life. And I think it's done in a really well, it's really, really well done. Yeah.
Some interesting cameo appearances.
There's loads of them. Like, you've got everyone, like Hank Azaria is in it as this very unfeeling funeral director. And then you have Jonathan Groff is in it as this New York obsessed small town personal, he's a personal trainer. I was going to say personal assistant. And then you have David Byrne pops up in it, which I was so astonished by, as her doctor. And he has this bizarre bedside manner and doesn't want to touch her.
Let's have a listen to the... And the I think possibly the worst dad joke in the world at the end of this clip. And here he is. It's David Byrne as the doctor. Beth is having difficult stomach pains and he wants to examine her, as you say, without touching her, which is quite difficult for when you have tummy pains.
How many drinks I have a day?
Yeah.
Probably four at night. Mm. And then a glass or two with lunch for work.
So how long have you drank like that? 4 to 6 drinks a day?
25 years.
Sneaks up on you.
Yeah.
Do you chew?
What do you mean?
Oh, how long do you chew your food?
Yeah, can we get to my stomach? Because I really think there must be some blockage or something.
You mentioned something about funeral arrangements.
My mom just died.
Oh, I'm sorry for your loss. You know, sometimes our mental pain manifests in our bodies.
Right. Yeah. Mm. That doesn't make any sense in this case, though, because I'm actually not in any sort of mental pain. Ow.
Oh, sorry, tender?
Yeah. No, it's fine. I have a bad back. That's not new.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, Beth, I'd recommend you chew more and drink less.
I chew.
Bless you.
He did say that. I had to rewind to check that I'd heard it correctly.
And that is
today.
A problem with it, because there is this disjointed
realism. David Byrne, sorry, I should say David Byrne there as the doctor, Amy Schumer as Beth in the series that Jen Gannon is speaking to us about, Life and Beth.
There is this like disjointed realism to it, and I think Beth seems very real. She's very believable, her character, but then the characters around her are strangely exaggerated. It's like she's in a dramedy and they're in a half an hour zany sitcom, and that can take away from it until I think it gets to episode 5, it settles down. It opens out into these bigger themes about grief and about her relationship with other people. Because I think a lot of the other characters are a bit one note. They're only there to kind of project what her flaws are. And it does give it this uneasy quality, this kind of uneven quality. You're very aware of it. The tone is all over the place. It doesn't really know what it wants to be until later on.
Yeah, because I wondered about, you know, sometimes the dramedy element of it kind of didn't kind of pull it. It didn't work for me. Whereas the comedy, I thought, I can see what she's doing there. To episode 3, and I thought, I'm kind of hooked now. I want to see more. You're at 5.
I was
Are
5
you totally hooked now?
Ten
in the series altogether.
Watch the whole series, and I do think it does capture that certain melancholy of returning to somewhere that you can't get to the place where you want to go, and you can't go back to the past, and she can't imagine a future for herself. And I thought that was really interesting. It's the best thing she's ever done, for sure. And it did sometimes remind me of Louis C.K.'s Louis. It has this very jazzy soundtrack, and the way it's shot, it's shot beautifully. But you know, Louis is much darker, much more troubling, much more surreal. But there was tinges to that too. There was that kind of quality to it. I think if the zanier elements were calmed down, there are two separate dance routines in it for no reason that really irritated me. And there's still those elements to it that just didn't quite work for me.
You kind of like Amy Schumer now, do you?
I respect her. I have a different view of her now, definitely, for sure.
But you're saying watch this.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the best work that she has ever done. And I think, you know, even though it wraps up too neatly at the end, I am wondering, is that giving room for maybe a second season that might calm down and bring all the elements together and make it better?
Okay, well, then Jen Gannon speaking to us about Life and Beth, which will be available on Disney Plus from tomorrow. Delighted to say that the Dublin Dance Festival back opens today and will run through until May the 29th, promising world-class flamingo, dazzling street dance and cutting-edge contemporary premieres. Among those cutting-edge premieres is A Call to You by Catherine Young Dance. Delighted to be joined on the programme in the studio this evening by Catherine. Catherine Young, when you started creating A Call to You, Catherine, you had a residency at the Backstage Theatre in County Longford. You were looking at this whole idea about, you know, you wanted to make a piece of work that would be against division, against divisiveness. And then Mr. Putin comes along and throws the curveball when he creates division, to say the very least, by invading Ukraine. How did that start to feed in, and how quickly did that start to feed into what you were doing?
Instantly. We were auditioning I was over in Belgium auditioning on the 24th, the day that he invaded. And kind of in that moment, I knew the piece would change. I can never ignore what's going on in the world when I'm making a piece of work. And then it turned out one of the dancers that I ended up taking on was of Ukrainian heritage. So we just, you know, in having discussions, it felt like this was something that we couldn't ignore. And not that we wanted to make a piece about Ukraine, but it felt that it was going to impact the work. And one of the challenges I set myself for the piece was not to go dark. I think I've spent the last 6 years making pieces about Palestine, rape provision, and coming out of 2 years of lockdown, it just felt for all of us to try and find some light, and also for audiences too. I think going to the theatre nowadays, I think we need some solace
after the period we've come through. Yeah. But again, is it difficult to talk about or indeed dance about and in and around themes of division without going to the dark place, or is it about rising above that division really that is what you're ultimately exploring here?
Yeah, I mean, there is a journey of the piece, and a lot of what we looked at was community, which I think we've kind of seen over lockdown, the importance of that. And in going from the kind of the individual, which the West has done, I think when I was in Palestine, I really saw how strong community was. And I think back in the West, we've lost a little bit of our relationship to other people, which we've maybe gained a little bit in the last 2 years. So that,
ironically, do you think that the isolation of COVID actually fed into a reconnecting just because we were so isolated and so separated from community?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it also showed us that we're connected, whether we like it or not. With the virus, we are connected, and you can't ignore the other. So I think I always believe that what affects one affects all, and what happens in Ukraine is affecting us, whether it be gas prices or whatever. You can't ignore it. So I've always, you know, felt that we, even with Palestine, the things that are happening around the world, we have to pay attention to. So, you know, with the work, it does go on that journey from the individual to the community. And community always isn't always good. You know, when you have kind of people come together, there can be the rise of the right and an opportunity for authoritarianism. I can't pronounce the word. So it kind of, the piece touches on both the positive and the negative of community. And there's almost a return to the folk, which is kind of where the folk dance came in.
Let's talk a little bit. But maybe tell me specifically, you mentioned about one of the dancers that then became part of what you were working on. Tell me Anna's full name.
Anna Kazuba.
Anna Kazuba, of Ukrainian heritage. So had she been living in and around where you were working on the piece up to this, or how had you met her?
I've worked with Anna in the past. She was in a piece of mine in 2016, so she's danced in Ireland quite frequently. And she lives in the UK, and her grandfather had come over to the UK after World War II. I think he lost a lot of his family and travelled there. So she had, with her father, travelled back to Kiev and the Ukraine in 2019 and had taken a couple of folk dance classes. So when we came in the room, she'd mentioned that, and I was, I think in all the pieces I've made, I always seem to gravitate towards a folk element. We did Dabke in the Palestinian piece, and I have a background in West African, and I feel folk is where there's an element of power, there's a power to change, and there's an element of power in folk dance that I've been, I guess, investigating over the last couple of years.
And I suppose when you think of, in very generic terms, really, I'm thinking of folk dance here, but I'm even thinking of, you know, certain Irish dances, big group dances, where you will have, you know, people weaving in and out of each other, inevitably making some kind of physical contact, or you'll have the six-hand reel or the 12-hand reel or the set dance in terms of Irish folk dance, if you like, where it's very much about a group of people as opposed to a solo or a pas de deux. What about Ukrainian folk dance? What did you learn about it?
It's very similar to a lot of folk dances. The one we settled on, it's called the Hutsulka. It's a circle dance, and it's traditionally done at weddings, and we love the rhythms of it and some of the movements in it, but with the structures of it, you need the other. It doesn't function like without the entire group, and we needed kind of an even number of people, and it without one person, all of the structures fall apart. So there's such a reliance, kind of tension wise and formation wise, with the group, that you can't do it on your own. And also when you're dancing, it's impossible not to be happy. I mean, once they start doing that section, just smiles come on the face instantaneously. It's really relational.
And the dancers here from all sorts of backgrounds and origins.
Yeah, they're all contemporary dancers, so it's kind of a foray into the folk.
But you did have a preview at the backstage, and you invited some Ukrainian refugees along to see that. That must have been a very potent and emotional evening.
Yeah, and I was kind of, you know, the moment where it was happening, you're kind of conscious that, you know, you're trying to, in some way, shape or form, kind of represent their dance form. And the reaction after the show was quite overwhelming. There was, you know, tears in a good way, I was told, that they didn't expect to see their dance and their music kind of represented on stage. And at one moment I was, you know, I usually sit at the back when I'm watching the show, and I was watching people film, and typically you'd be there to stop.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I had that sensation that this must be, they're most likely probably the refugees. And at the end, the translator, because a lot of them didn't speak English, said that some of them were sending videos of the folk dance back to their sons. Yeah.
Yeah.
And kind of watching the show, suddenly all the gestures earlier in the show just were seen, and for me, I've seen them in a different way when you're watching it from that set of eyes.
So through the eyes of those who have been directly involved. Let's have a listen to a piece of some of the music that's used in the piece. In the overall piece is called A Call to You, and the composer here is Martin Shearer. Let's have a listen. So just a little flavour there of Martin Shearer's original music for the show A Call to You, with Catherine Young of Catherine Young Dances speaking to me about this evening. And I was saying as we were listening to that there is a sense of those, particularly in music that comes from central and eastern parts of Europe, you often get those kind of cross rhythms and slightly jumping rhythms that give the dance a particular type of momentum, Catherine.
Yeah, it gives it a real drive, and the tempo is one thing that we keep, because there is parts of contemporary dance in there, and then when you fuse the two, or when you have the two aligned, it's so driving with the folk that the contemporary stuff can be a real challenge to get through that.
So does the folk win the battle in many
ways? Because when you slow down one, then the other doesn't work. So the folk has to have this drive and has to keep going. And I think that's where the life, you know, the force comes from is the drive of the music and drive of the rhythms.
Are there other traditions? Obviously, it's understandable that Ukrainian folk music should have had such a particular place in this piece. Are there other traditions that make their way into the work?
In this show, no, we've kept it. It's mostly contemporary music and Ukrainian folk. We've kind of kept it based, you know, steeped in one tradition.
And you were mentioning there about how in some ways the folk, the rhythm and the drive of the folk rhythm can take over the perhaps that looser feel that you might have in a contemporary dance move. Did that happen to Michael's music as well? Martin Shearer's music.
Towards the end, it does end up gravitating towards counts and going on beat, and you know there isn't a moment to fall asleep. It's normally we wouldn't count in contemporary dance; you'd feel it or go with the breath. But once you go into the Ukrainian stuff, it's all counted. It's all on beats.
Again, and this struck me, you know, since the whole theme here is about division and divisiveness, and I suppose about conquering that, and therefore community and coming together is kind of the antidote to that. It has struck me on a number of occasions how dance in particular, and folk dance even more so, that physical connection, that people actually connecting with each other. Again, if we go back to the eight-hand reel where, you know, you'll swap partners and you'll go across and you'll make all sorts of different shapes across the room, the eight of you together, four of you separate, all of that type of thing. That physical connection is hugely important and wasn't there during COVID.
Absolutely. And one of the big things that we had to work on coming into the rehearsal room was touch, you know, the dancers not having been doing gigs for 2 years. It took a while before we could touch and kind of get comfortable with the quality of touch. And once you kind of bypass that, then absolutely, it is that there's a power in that coming together and having to physically hold someone's hands or hold someone's back and physically dance with them.
And this is a companion piece to work that you've created, two pieces, Floating on Dead Sea and State of Exception, and the forthcoming Universal Declaration. That's a trilogy then that those three pieces are going to make.
Yeah, and I was originally going to go into Universal Declaration straight after Floating on a Dead Sea, which looks at the whole area of human rights, but it just felt, you know, coming out of lockdown with the war, it just felt kind of too much too soon, and that I needed to make a piece that had more of a glimmer of hope and a bit of joy. And
yeah,
inspiration.
Because I think the floating on the Dead Sea was based on a visit you made to Ramallah. So I guess the Ukrainian situation kind of overtook those, but you'll revisit, I'm sure.
Yeah, we hope to tour Floating next year. We premiered that back in the height of COVID back in November, so we aim to bring that back next year. Yeah.
Right, well, okay. And in the meantime, A Call to You is the new work by Catherine Young Dance. It will be performed as part of Dublin Dance Festival on Friday and Saturday, May the 20th and 21st. That's at the Project Arts Centre. More information on dublindancefestival.ie. Thanks for coming into us this evening, Catherine.